John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
Welcome to a Conversation Hour today that will feature several remarkable women. One of them, one of the leading female entrepreneurs in the United States, Kay Koplowitz, who, apart from other things, has chaired the National Council of Business for Women in the United States. She works in network television, which is where she's a big boss and a big name, and she'll be joining us, as well as Anne Goldstein, who's famous for having translated Eleanor Ferrante's work, as well as Primo Levi. How do you reinterpret in another language all the nuance, all the fine points, all the detail of someone's writing? When you think about it, it's an extraordinary job. Well, that's what Anne does. And so Anne and Kay will join us shortly. And speaking of remarkable women, Jill Singer, journalist, author, co-host on The Conversation Hour, is here to hold my hand for The Conversation Hour today. Morning to you, Jill.
Good morning. Lovely task.
What, keeping me in shape?
That's right.
I will say very, very little. How have you been?
I've been well. It's funny. I know we'll get onto language later, but poor Kay out there, I sat down next to her and I knew she'd just arrived recently from America. I said, how are you going, bucket? And she looked at me and then someone with her said, she's very tired, yes.
You could have called on Anne Goldstein.
I could have called on Anne Goldstein.
The translator to translate your greeting.
Could you interpret Australian for me?
To Kay Koplowitz.
Yeah.
That's a very worthwhile exercise.
I have to keep checking myself, I think.
Yeah, we've learned that over the years.
You have.
So what have you been up to?
I've been up to a lot of things. I'm no longer with RMIT. I'm now mainly working for myself and working on what I want to work on. So I have freedom, which is important to me.
So you were teaching journalism.
I was teaching.
Sorry,
and part, journalism. And the student side and the teaching side I really love, but there are lots of problems with academia now, as many people would know.
The dreaded administration.
It's a dreaded administration. It's a lot of pressures really on the sector to get more students through, to get fees higher. It's a lot of pressure and it's not necessarily I want to be part of anymore.
We all make those decisions from
time
to time.
We do make those decisions. So now I feel cleaner and free.
Cleaner.
Right.
So you felt dirty before.
I did feel a little grubby at times, John, I've got to say.
Okay. Is there a story there?
There is, and I'll be writing it.
Oh, right.
Okay. I'm very busy writing. I'm working on a number of essays and various things. And part of that, too, is I've just had the experiences I'm having. I'm more interested in experiences now than having things or job status. And one of the great experiences I had recently was going and doing a story in Poland and coming back here. That was about property restitution after the Holocaust. It let me get into a lot about free speech, human rights, etc. in Poland and reflect more on Australia. And now it's very hard to be pompous and lecturing when you go somewhere like Poland and you see the way the media is clamping down on free speech. And then you come back here and you realise how much propaganda and manipulation of speech there is, that we can actually have practices going on, like in Nauru, like with refugees, where people are told to shut up all the time, or voices are not listened to, where things are covered up. I mean, Dutton's latest pronouncements. The fact that he could even go so far to say something so atrocious shows how eroded our discussion is about the needs and rights of refugees.
Now, Poland's just elected a new government, which is populist. They've sacked a whole lot of judges. They've replaced the head of the broadcasting organisation with someone who is more friendly to the government rather than someone who's hostile to the government.
They're changing everything. The cultural institutions too. There's a real history war going on.
Okay.
So with Poland,
so what was it like? What's it like in the streets? What's it like as you spend time there?
Wonderful. So much about Poland is brilliant. I mean, it's an incredibly beautiful country. People are friendly. There's a real generational difference that I could see in the time I was there. Understandably, older people are scared, fearful, bitter. They've been through terribly traumatic times at the hands in living memory of the Nazis and communists. And it's really only since 1989 that there has been, the end of the communist regime. So for younger people, 26 and younger, they've had a different outlook on life, and they're more outward looking. Most of them are learning English and love interacting with visitors. So there's a real difference, and there's a big shift. But this government is hard at work trying to change the narrative about history.
In Poland. Yeah.
And they're working very...
Well, that's what the people voted for. It's not like people didn't know what they were getting when they voted for the right-wing government in Poland.
It's not necessarily that it's right-wing either. It's a complicated political system.
Nationalist.
And it's socially conservative. It's backed by the church. Mm-hmm. But they are pumping money in domestically into various supports. I don't think many people know exactly how they feel about private property yet. These things are coming out, so it's hard to pinpoint what this government is about. It's not about free speech, though. There's a very, very good American historian, Holocaust scholar called Jan Gross, who's done the most brilliant work. And at one stage, he was very well regarded in Poland, reluctantly. But he was responsible for examining and revealing a lot of the continuing persecution of the Jews at the end of the Second World War, when the Nazis were defeated. These were stories that were not welcome in many sectors, because the narrative was meant to go that Polish righteous Gentiles saved Jews and they whitewashed the pogroms afterwards. This is what's happening. And a lot of institutions are under pressure to play down these atrocities that were committed by Gentile Poles. So there's this... Gross has come out with some comments saying, well, perhaps his language is immoderate and you can always argue about the figures, but he has said, look, if you come down to it, the Poles ended up killing more Jews than Germans. This has now seen him charged.
Sorry, that's a bit ambiguous. The Poles killed more Jews than Germans killed Jews, or the
no,
Germans
then they killed
more
Germans.
Jews than
then
they
killed
Germans.
Then right. They killed Germans.
Okay.
Right. Now, you can argue about all these figures and which groups are you talking about. Are you talking about the underground? Are you talking about this? So you can get down to those arguments. But the mere fact is that he said that a year ago, and now he's been charged with insulting Poland.
Yeah. Which is a bit like what happens now in Turkey, where you can be charged with insulting the president, and even someone
in
Germany,
yes,
who wrote a cartoon about the Turkish president,
that's right,
has been arrested for insulting the president of Turkey whilst publishing a cartoon in Germany.
Well, it's like, Thailand, you can't say anything about the royal family.
What the hell is going on there?
Yeah, what is going on? But equally, John, you know, we look at this and then we think, well, come back to Australia. What can you say? When the Save the Children people said... in Nauru, these people, the human rights are being abused. These are terrible things. These people were vilified for saying it. Mm-hmm. Now, we think we learn from things. No. What happens in Nauru? We have desperate refugees self-immolating, the most appalling circumstances. And then you have the government still feeling free that they can say, oh, well, advocates... refugee advocates are causing this, that they can even think of saying that they get away with saying it.
Well,
how eroded?
Peter Dutton offered to help me arrange a visa to go and visit Nauru, and wrote a letter to the Justice Minister of Nauru saying, I would like you to extend a visa to this particular Australian journalist in order to do
when
a visit.
When did he do that?
Oh, a couple of months ago when I had him on air and I challenged him over some of these issues live to air.
Can I carry your bags?
And he said, you can go to Nauru. And I said, well, what about all the secrecy? What about all the blah, blah, blah? And he said, well, if you want to go to Nauru, why don't you go? And I said, because you can't get in. And he said, I'll help you get in. And he did. He sent me a copy of the email that was sent to the government of Nauru. And I then followed it up and 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 followed it up. And then I gave up. So it was quite clear that whilst... in response to the challenge, Mr. Dutton said, I will facilitate a visit for you to Nauru. It wasn't actually going to happen. So no. There you go.
And then they hope it will all be forgotten. And the thing is, how much is it now to apply for a visa? Is it 7,000 to apply for a visa to Nauru?
No, 5, I think it is.
5. And if you don't get it, you don't get your money back.
No, you don't. And it's also, but look, either way, the money's only a small part of it. The issue is you can't actually get permission. And even if you get permission to go to Nauru, do you get permission to go and see the camps? And if you get into the camps, do you get permission to talk to anybody who's not directly under the control of the private contractor? So there's a whole lot of levels and layers of issues, but either way, it's academic until
they're keeping appalling things hidden from us. And even when we find out about these things,
they may be, they may not be. I don't know. Certainly, when you talk to people who have worked there, and I've spoken to people who have been there as well in various professional capacities, I don't want to get anybody into trouble because they're not supposed to talk about what they see there and what they do there, but they're significant issues, undoubtedly, that are not coming to light. Jill Singer, my co-host, no longer with RMIT University, where she was teaching journalism, but our first guest on the Conversation Hour in a moment. Kay Koplowitz is chair and co-founder of Springboard Enterprises. She's an entrepreneur, which is not a term of abuse. Morning to you, Kay.
Good morning.
In some circles, entrepreneur comes with all sorts of loaded meaning, doesn't it?
I think they're all good. I mean, I think entrepreneurs are really the people that innovate, change, the way we do things, introduce new kinds of businesses, move the culture forward. I think I think entrepreneurship is a great career.
What? Wasn't it George Bush Senior who said the French don't even have a word for entrepreneur?
Well, everybody, I must say, the United States of America has led the world in entrepreneurship, I think, and especially in terms of the amount of capital deployed against it.
At what point do you call yourself an entrepreneur? At what point are you not just a business person, but you've actually kind of got the elevated status?
Well, I think if you start businesses, if you're the founder of businesses and you start them and grow them, I think that – and I think it's a lot about the psychology of a person. You really want to take that risk. It's a little bit more of a risk that people are taking to launch a business and really support it, find the capital, hire people. There's a lot to it. It's very different than holding a job.
Kate, what you're doing is sort of essentially like a shark tank that we see on TV, except it's not sharkish. I understand that the teeth are not bitey.
Call it the dolphin tank.
The dolphin tank, mm-hmm. Okay. Could you explain the difference between a dolphin tank and a shark tank?
Sure. We are bringing women entrepreneurs to the marketplace, and the reason we say it's a dolphin tank is because dolphins are mammals. They travel in communities. They help and protect their own, and we think that dolphins are more of who we are. We really work hard and critique our entrepreneurs We're pretty tough on them in terms of how we critique them. We deconstruct their businesses, and then we help them reconstruct them in understanding how to go to market to raise capital. So yesterday, we started our boot camp here in Sydney for companies all from all over the country, 10 entrepreneurs, and we deconstructed them yesterday. Today, they get reconstructed, so it'll be a very interesting process.
Would have been a tough night for them overnight in between.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got 10 people Australia-wide for this slot, is that right?
Yes. Our boot camps and our training sessions are not about masses of people. They're about the right companies. And we look at them as companies that are scalable and sustainable at a scaled level. So we're dealing with companies that we feel are at the top of the pyramid. We're not looking for mass. These are people that are building companies meant to scale, go global.
And scale, when you say go scale, that's a technical term, a term of business art. What does it mean in simple English for people?
To build companies of size and to really scale to a size that you can launch out of Australia, in case of Australia here, out of Australia into a global marketplace. So we have been in operation for 16 years. And so we really have a very tightly controlled learning process, education process for these entrepreneurs who are really in technologies and life sciences like biotech and devices diagnostics, and then all kinds of software, media tech, financial technology, all kinds of technology companies, that launch out of Australia and be able to not only capture a market here in Australia, but be able to go out into the United States, into Asia, into different parts of the world, and really build a global business out of it.
I can understand that you have this for women because there would be different challenges in encouraging women in terms of getting venture capital, in terms of perhaps confidence, perhaps in how the language they use in reaching out. The types of businesses and the types of ideas, though, are you seeing marked differences than you might see, say, from a mixed group, from the women budding entrepreneurs?
Well, women entrepreneurs have to compete in the general, you know, economy, so they have to be competitive in areas that equity capital is funding. The companies that we have here this year are in technologies, healthcare, IT, SaaS models, several that have SaaS models that are in the mining industry and the healthcare industry.
What's a SaaS model?
And SaaS means it is a service business that is a licensed business. And so people license the product. That's what a SaaS business is. It's really a licensing model business, which is really very typical in the technology industry today. Licensing their product to other companies to solve a problem for them.
Okay. Someone gave me recently a copy of a report written by McKinsey & Co., the international business consultants, saying we're entering a decade of no growth. How does that change the business model that you and others have for so long relied upon?
Growth on a macro scale may be the case. We've seen slowing down on the global basis of growth, not in every country. It does change, but let's say in the most developed countries, that seems to be true, that there's been somewhat of a slowing of growth. But that doesn't mean that there isn't dislocation and disruptive businesses that are coming to market.
Sure.
So you look at the sharing economy, and I think everyone here will know what Uber is. They will know what Airbnb is. They'll know about companies like that are vastly disrupting industries. The transportation industry, the hotel industry, these things are disruptive. And we're going to see massive changes in the healthcare industry coming along because of what we've learned since the mapping of the genome, what we can do with technology, what we can do with 3D printing of joints, for example, that are replacement joints that are in high demand, especially as populations age. The way we communicate in healthcare IT, technology applied to how healthcare is served to the patients between hospitals and doctors and practitioners and the patients. Those things are going to change vastly in the next 20 years. So maybe the mass on a macro level, we're saying the growth is slowed. It's going to be 1 to 2% instead of 3 to 4% on the average, possibly. But inside those numbers, there are going to be massive changes.
But if you've got asset deflation, if you've got price deflation, if you've got negative interest rates, the fundamentals on which most businesses have been based are shot to bits.
So how does that affect entrepreneurs? Is that your question?
I think, raising capital
and
finding markets and exploiting opportunities in a shrinking economy.
Interestingly enough, I think people are looking for ways to get better returns on their capital. And
sometimes
they're not getting it from the banks.
Any return would be good now.
They're not getting it from the banks. Yeah. And so you have new companies that have come to market, peer-to-peer lending in the United States, and probably here to some degree. The banks have not been lending at small business level in many communities. It's much harder for the small business operator, the local business operator, the shopkeepers, who are very much part of the economy, to get loans. And so what has stepped in the breach? Peer-to-peer lending, where people are lending to other people or other businesses for a return that is greater than what they could get from their local bank by keeping their money in a savings account. I think it's a clear example of how innovation is, even in a slow-growth economy, is changing businesses.
Kay, I wonder, when you support these entrepreneurs and see these different businesses springing up, is there any data being collected in terms of the work practices, human resources approach to running a business in terms of ethical businesses, that we might see a shift with women coming in, or is there not much difference?
Well, I don't know about a cultural shift. I think that women are generally a little bit more aware of sort of the pressures of being a woman, being a mother, you know, other things that generally women are more apt to be taking care of, the health care of their family, the different, you know, support systems of family, and understand that a little bit more. I will say that there have been some differences in the United States in terms of acceptance of women who are giving birth and being able to have rooms for breastfeeding and things like this that are changing the landscape. So I think that this is just acceptance of women as human beings, which is just wonderful, that we should have that status since we're a little over half the population. So I think you're seeing some changes in the marketplace with more women in the business marketplace and as entrepreneurs. But still on an economic basis, on a financial basis, they still have to perform at par or better for financial returns, and they do. Let me just say that women entrepreneurs in our sector, technology and life sciences, and the ones we see that are coming to the forefront, do raise less capital than men, 30 to 40% less, and overperform in revenues by 12%. So this is basically one of the reasons I founded Springboard Enterprises with my colleagues, was really to say women can really perform in this category if they're given a shot. And yes,
and
it's nice.
Lower risk.
And it's nice to say they can perform above average with less capital. Mm. But I say, what if they had capital on par? What would they do? And my goal is to get women on parity. My goal is to see women just go out there and be able to compete and raise capital at the same rate as men. And that's what we're working toward.
Fascinating. On women and parity and power, I know that you've met Donald Trump on a number of occasions, and your background is in, your eyes just went up to the ceiling of the studio then, and that you've worked in broadcast television and cable for much of your career. You know the media very well. I'm interested in the news landscape and how it might be changing and what's happening with the networks in America. How much have they aided and abetted and created Donald Trump?
Well, I think that Donald Trump has gotten about $2 billion worth of free media in this primary election season because he's an extraordinary marketer, I think, more than even the successful businessman that he claims to be. It's that his profile from The Apprentice makes him a household name across America. And he has gotten the amount of press because it drives ratings and it drives headlines, and he's done it by attacking, by being pejorative and I think extremely negative about other people, calling everybody names and making up facts of his own that aren't facts. So I really think the media has been sucked into his vortex, and I think in the general election I hope to see more scrutiny of the facts that he claims are statements he claims are facts, because I think the media has been complicit. And I think that most media people would say that today, too. I would not be the only person saying that. I think people in the media realize they did not scrutinize his activities the way they did everybody else in the Republican primary. So no one else, he just sucked up all the air and no one else got the media coverage. Of the 11 other candidates who were running, they all together didn't get anywhere near the coverage that Donald got.
Why does the news media go along with this, though? I can understand you might say
ratings.
Ratings, yes, and our proprietor, perhaps the editorial ideological push of coming down from above. Or sometimes, perhaps, do you think the newsrooms just know what is wanted of them?
I think they're all in competition with one another to have ratings,
and
you know,
it becomes
tribal. I do think he's it's like a reality show. I mean, he's turned the election into a reality show, and so I think that the people are just eating this up, and from that perspective. But I think when you try to think about it as a citizen of the United States, you think about, is this the kind of person that should be leading the United States of America? And I would emphatically say no.
And yet in the primary result this morning, Bernie Sanders has beaten Hillary Clinton, it seems, by a very narrow margin in the latest primary race. And here is, it's another embarrassing setback for Hillary Clinton, who thought that the Democrat nomination was hers for the taking.
I don't think that Hillary Clinton or the Hillary Clinton campaign assumed that she was going to be the designated candidate on the Democratic side. I think they knew that there was going to be a fight. I do think that Bernie Sanders has electrified a portion of the electorate.
Young people in particular.
Yeah, and young people in particular, because his platform is free college.
He's saying politics, as is Trump. Politics is a racket.
People are
not an insider, and I'll change things.
Yeah, and he is. And so I think that he has a message that resonates with people, and
no
he is gathering
it.
Some momentum. But I,
away
you know,
from
we'll
politics.
See. We'll see how it comes out before the or by the time of the convention.
Just before our next guest joins us, before we go, leaving politics but back to business. Are women allowed to make mistakes in business the way men are?
Depends on what company they're with or what the business mistakes are.
I've got a view that women are judged much more harshly. Men make mistakes all the time, and that's thought to be part of business.
I think it's generally true that women are judged more harshly by both men and women.
By men and women?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so women are harsher on women as well.
I think they are. I think that's true. I think women have to perform at a higher standard.
That's the start of another whole discussion.
I read this great article yesterday.
We could put another hour aside right there.
John, I'll be very quick. I read this great article yesterday about trans men being interviewed, a number of them, women who transitioned to become male. And they were saying how much easier life was as a man. Really, in terms of their careers and everything like that, they did so much better.
Yeah.
So much better.
There's another hour. Look, we've just created and spawned so many more topics for conversation. Kay, thank you indeed. Kay Koplowitz, who's chair and co-founder of Springboard Enterprises here in Australia for some workshops, founder of the USA Network Pay TV, sits on the board of all sorts of corporations, including the University of Wisconsin, Time Incorporated, Ion Media Networks. She's on the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Many, many different irons in her fire, and was appointed to chair the National Council of Business for Women in the USA by President Bill Clinton. Sadly, Kay has to go and catch a plane. That's our loss. But Kay, thank you very much for joining us in the studio this morning.
Thank you.
Kay Koplowitz, our first guest. Anne Goldstein is a translator and an editor. She works at The New Yorker, and she's a recipient of all sorts of awards for translation, including the Penn Renato Poggioli Translation Prize. She's responsible for translating Elena Ferrante's work and Primo Levi's work and all sorts of other authors as well. Anne Goldstein is our other guest on The Conversation Hour today with Jill Singer, my co-host. And Anne, good morning to you.
Hello. Good morning.
How do you learn the nuance of translating? How do you go through that process of turning someone's words in one language into a solid representation of their feelings and their emotions in another?
I think it's a detailed process of going word for of translating word for word. To some extent, it's word for word, sentence for sentence, the sentence in the paragraph. It's a sort of slow, detailed process.
Do you have to get into the writer's head to do it?
Well, I think that eventually you do get into the writer's head. I mean, once you've read the book and started working on it, you do become in some sense that writer. I mean, you're not that writer, but you certainly are starting to hear that writer's sentences in your mind. Both in both languages, the sentences that you're creating out of that writer's original words and the original sentences.
A lot of people I've spoken with who have read the Neapolitan novels of Elena Ferrante, which I did earlier this year, was totally mesmerised by them and couldn't stop reading them. Just read them bulimically from start to finish.
Yeah.
And a lot of women I know read them like that and became very, very immersed and felt almost for a while like they were in Naples. How much did you become immersed yourself in the stories of two women protagonists in Naples throughout a tumultuous, tumultuous period of history. How much did you feel engaged with those characters?
Well, completely, in a certain sense. I mean, you know, they were sort of living in my head, or I was living with them in my head very much. When I remember when I finished translating the third novel, I was thinking, my life seems a little bit empty. What's going on here?
Yes.
And I felt that these characters were not in my head, and there was something definitely missing from my life. Because, yeah, you do get very involved in them, as you do as a reader, but perhaps even more as a translator, because you're reading so closely and you're reading them so many times.
Yeah. One thing in terms of the translation of the Neapolitan novels, when Ellen Ferrante, or whoever she is,
right.
writes, she often writes and refers to people whether they use dialect at a particular time or mm-hmm. they use, you know, very good Italian,
mm-hmm.
as part of their power and what they might do in different circumstances. So mm-hmm. when a person will use dialect, and it's for various reasons, political reasons mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. people have for speaking in a certain way. When you came to translate that, I was wondering, Elena Ferrante would say, well, so-and-so then reverted to dialect and spoke like mm-hmm. this. In the original, did she actually just use the dialect?
No.
Right.
She does not write in dialect, which is, thank goodness, for the translator.
I was wondering how hard that would be
because
for
I don't know. I don't know Neapolitan.
Yes.
But she says, as you said, she says he or she said in dialect. But dialect is definitely the language of the family.
Yes.
The language of home, the language of of children, the language of violence, and she uses it. I mean, to that effect, I think she probably didn't write in actual dialect because she wanted people to read her.
Yes,
and many Italians wouldn't be able to read dialect or to understand the dialect. But yes, she does use it very in a kind of a political way. I mean, I mean, speaking in dialect or speaking in Italian is a sign of education.
Yes.
You know, which is then becomes Italian's a class thing.
It's a relatively recent national language, Italian.
Yes.
We forget that very often.
Yeah, right. That every region of Italy has its, not just region, sometimes every town has its own dialect, and it's not necessarily understood by the neighbors. So, yes, it is a relatively recent phenomenon. Standard Italian brought about somewhat partly by television, by the fact that people move to the cities a lot now. You know, there isn't so much rural life or isolated life. So, yes.
I can't remember who it was, but there was a guest on this program once who said that when they left, having been born, I think, in Sicily and then mm-hmm. gone back, they discovered that their form of Sicilian in their family was pure because it had been quarantined locked away within their family and hadn't in any way grown and evolved the way Sicilian language had evolved since their family had left. And so when they went back, they couldn't speak any, even though they were Sicilian and they were in Sicily, mm-hmm. they couldn't necessarily speak to contemporary Sicilians because Sicilian had moved along in a generation
that's
and
really
they hadn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard that. What I've heard is, I mean, in the Neapolitan novels, there's a rather poignant moment when Elena, the one who leaves Naples and lives in other parts of Italy, in the north of Italy, which is, of course, considered the more educated, cultured, part of Italy. When she comes back to Naples and she's talking to Lila, her friend. And she feels that her dialect is in some way forced, and she can't really, she sort of lost the ability to speak naturally in dialect, and it's kind of a tragic moment for her, I think.
So how does a Goldstein from New York become an Italian translator and an expert in the nuances of Italian dialect?
Well, it's by chance, really. I mean, I started translating just by chance, and...
But how did you become fond of and immersed in Italian?
I studied Dante in college, and I developed a great passion to read Dante in Italian. I had read it in a parallel text. I had studied Latin and French in high school and as a child, really. And then in college, when I read Dante, I just was overwhelmed by it. And then it still took a few years before I convinced some of my colleagues at The New Yorker to... that they also wanted to learn Italian and read Dante. But we did. We had an Italian class with a teacher. We studied grammar for about a year, and then we read Dante.
After 1 year?
Well, yes. It was a little bit bold. but we did. We read all of Dante. We read all of the Divine Comedy.
And then?
And then I kept on with my Italian. I took a couple of classes. I kept reading. And then one day a book came to the New Yorker that was written in Italian, and the editor gave it to me and said, could you read this? I need to write a letter to the person. So I just thought, you know, I read it and I really liked it. It was a book called Chekhov and Sandrio by a writer, not well-known Italian writer called Aldo Buzzi. And I just thought, I'm going to try translating it. I'd like to get closer to this book. And I think that translating is really a very intimate form of reading.
Does it mess with your mind in a positive way? Because I used to, 25 years ago when I started working here at the ABC, I used to have to edit tape. So I would record interviews with people and then I would put that on tape or be on tape, and then I would have to cut the tape with a razor blade and splice it together to take out the ums and the ahs. And
yes.
You might take something that was said at the end of an interview and you'd put it at the front of an interview and turn it around, and you started thinking.
And totally changed the meaning of it?
No.
editorial process
I'm just
Thanks,
teasing.
Jill. No, you might. Someone might have said something really interesting at the end and you wanted to start the interview with the most interesting thing.
Yeah,
so
sure.
You just turned it around and swapped the order. But it meant that I started thinking. As people were talking, I'd start editing them in my head.
Oh.
Do you do that? Do you translate in your head when people are talking to you?
Well, sometimes, sure. I mean, yeah, sometimes if I'm working on Italian particularly, or if I'm, you know, thinking about having a conversation with somebody who's Italian. I do think sometimes in Italian, or I try to think in Italian.
And can you write for yourself instead of translating other people?
In Italian?
In any language. Because the professional editor often suffers from deferred writer syndrome.
It's not that I don't feel that. I don't feel that I wish that I were the writer, or that I was the person, you know, I could do a better job, but I would be the writer, or even that I want to write for myself. No. But there's definitely a sense of thinking in terms of, I don't know exactly.
And I think it's very interesting that the Ferrante phenomenon, that people don't know who this woman is, and she's obviously one of the greatest living writers that we have. I find it fascinating. I don't want to know who she is. I don't really particularly admire people trying to chase down and work out the mystery. I think she's very clever in that she now gets to write with utter freedom, that she can write, as some people say, like you should be able to write, like, which is your family is dead, write like your family is dead, and she can, which is a wonderful creative freedom that she has. I also think it's very clever in terms of a legacy. Often people write to be remembered, etc. What she has done is become a publishing phenomenon where after she is dead, people will know. It will come out who she is, and that will keep it going. It doesn't happen this way in our society, that people can keep that control over their creative process. So I'm incredibly impressed with her. I wonder how what your views are of this person that you will not meet or will not know, and whose work you know so intimately.
Well, I don't know who she is, and I've never felt really a compulsion to know who she is or to meet her. I think that she's very present in her work.
Yes.
You just have a sense, not necessarily literally the narrators of her, but that there's a voice that's very clear and present, and that's the person that I feel that I know in some way.
And then it's a bit like when someone leaves a novel to be published after their death, you suddenly go, oh, okay. We saw it recently with To Kill a Mockingbird and the sequel.
Oh, yeah, right. No, I know. I haven't really thought about it, what will happen after she dies.
Well, I think it'll all come out then.
I suppose it will, yeah, because there will be...
But then her body of work is done?
Hmm? Yeah, yeah. And then people will enjoy, I guess, dissecting at her
life and seeing what part of it was her and was not. I'm just extraordinarily grateful to a woman who can write in such a nuanced way about the terrible things that women can do as well as the noble and heroic things.
Yeah. No, she is amazing. I mean, she's actually talked about how not being a public person does enable her to have that freedom.
It does.
And she says, and she also talks about how she's, as a writer, she is violating the people she knows in some way.
Oh, yes, plundering them mercilessly.
And she says it's a violent act, writing.
It is.
But she's
protected herself pretty well.
Yes, yes.
And that's a pattern that's been repeated from time to time in all sorts of other genres too. But I've got some fabulous text messages here apropos of what we were talking about a few moments ago. When my husband visited Sicily, writes Steve's wife, which is where his grandfather came from, the locals were hugely entertained by his Sicilian dialect. They told him repeatedly how quaint it was, how it was like speaking to someone from a time capsule because his grandfather had left in the 1920s. And his children and grandchildren continued speaking the Sicilian dialect of that time, says Steve's wife. Kate in Glenburn says, I'm an Auslan English interpreting and translating student at RMIT. Thank you and your guest for giving time to this subject. It's so complicated, so complex, and it's a rare opportunity to hear someone talking about it. But on the other hand, Lulu's not happy. Lulu says, as a Neapolitano, I must object to the description of the North as being better educated.
Oh, well, of course, it's a cliched kind of.
It was at the time, really, in terms of going off to Milan to.
No,
get
I mean,
ahead.
As I was saying, I was thinking of Naples is one of the oldest cultures. I mean, it's. You know, it's fantastic.
Well, it's Pompeii and all. And, the South is disadvantaged economically, but a large portion now of Neapolitans are well educated here in Naples. Yeah. In fact, the tertiary educated are a large group here, says Lulu. So I think we can.
And we should point out that Naples is the most stunning city.
Yes.
Just beautiful.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily so. So, and when you teach others about translating and when you're working as an editor, the mental process, the intellectual exercise, is it the same if you're working in two languages as if you're editing in one?
No, it's not exactly the same. I mean, it shares some aspects. I mean, like the idea of attention to detail, attention to grammar, attention to the way people write. But of course, there is an extra element when you're dealing with two languages. I mean, You're not just trying to express something as well as possible in the one language, but you have to take it from the second language and make it into the first language, and then make it as good as possible in the first language. in English.
Do you ever revert to asking someone for a second ear or a second reading and say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you just check this and see if I've got it?
Oh,
because you get so close sometimes to the words.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, lots of time. I mean, there are always difficulties in a translation, things that you don't understand, things that are hard to understand, things that are complex. And I often ask Italians, about things, and I would say they often don't agree with each other about the meaning of something.
Nor necessarily should they.
Right, exactly. So
we don't agree with each other in English all the time.
But you're always making a choice, like what is the most important aspect of this word or this sentence, or which of course the original writer didn't have to do.
And getting it across, it's an absolute joy when you do. And that the words sing on the page. There's no doubt about that. It's the same. I remember talking to a film subtitler on the program talking about exactly how you do that, because very often the dialogue in a film is way too fast for subtitles and you've got to translate and abbreviate it at the same time. It's an extraordinary thing. And it's wonderful to have you here. Anne Goldstein is an editor at The New Yorker. She's a recipient of the Pen Renato Poggioli Translation Prize, has translated all of Eleanor Ferranti's work and other authors, including Primo Levi. Kay Koplowitz, our other guest, has had to go to catch a plane. She's the chair and co-founder of Springboard Enterprises, on the board of all sorts of organisations, including Time magazine and also the University of Wisconsin, was the chair of Bill Clinton's National Council of Business for Women, and was our first guest talking about women entrepreneurs on The Conversation Hour today with Jill Singer, my co-host.